Welcome to Consider the Constitution, the podcast that cuts through the noise and provides insight into constitutional issues that directly affect every American. Hosted by Dr. Katie Crawford Lackey and featuring interviews with constitutional scholars, policy and subject matter experts, heritage professionals, and legal practitioners, we examine the rights and responsibilities of citizenship. Consider the Constitution is brought to you by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
Hello, and welcome back to Consider the Constitution. I'm your host, Dr. Katie Crawford Lackey, Director of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. The lives and stories of influential figures such as George Washington, James Madison, and other founders are interwoven into this narrative of America's founding. In modern day, these men are often elevated to an almost mythical status in U.S. history and in pop culture. However, in noting the contributions these men made towards this great democratic experiment, we sometimes overlook fundamental aspects of their humanity. On today's episode, we're exploring the individuals behind the legend of our country's founding, their strengths, flaws, aspirations, and complexities. And it's an honor to welcome David O. Stewart, who will help shed some light on these topics. David has published 5 books of history and 5 historical novels. His nonfiction works include Madison's Gift, 5 Partnerships That Built America, and The Summer of 1787, The Men Who Invented the Constitution. His most recent work of nonfiction, George Washington, The Political Rise of America's Founding Father, has won several awards for Best Work of History for 2021. His most recent novel, The Burning Land, is set during the Civil War and its aftermath and is inspired by family stories his mother told. David practiced law for more than 25 years as a trial and appellate lawyer and has challenged government actions as unconstitutional in the U.S. Supreme Court. David, it's such an honor to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Now, at Montpelier, where we're sitting right now in Orange County, Virginia, we give tours and host this podcast, and we often talk about the Constitutional Convention of 1787 and the debate and compromise that was necessary to come to a consensus in drafting the U.S. Constitution. We don't, however, talk as much about the visionary leadership of the framers. Now, I'll note that leadership has varied definitions and is carried out depending on the person. David, as a scholar who has researched and written extensively on the convention and on these framers, what can you tell us about the role of leadership and the role these men played at the Constitutional Convention?
I always start with the context of the convention. The country was in terrible shape. We'd come through an ugly war that was fought on our land, which is always bad, and our economy was in tatters. It was the worst depression in our history. It was worse than the Great Depression of the 1930s. Tremendous unemployment and poverty and want. So things were not working well. The states in particular were not getting along with each other. And a good reason for that was the structure of the government we had for the nation, which was not much structure. It was the Articles of Confederation, and it had very few powers and the sort of rules that made it very hard even to exercise those powers. So the first decision was we have to change things. And that is the basic act of leadership I see as most important, both to diagnose that, but also to make it happen. And I give the greatest credit to George Washington and James Madison for that. They both saw it, felt it deeply. I think Madison gets credit for sort of elbowing Washington in the ribs and saying, you know, you're the guy, you got to do this. And Washington was the guy. The founding era, if you wanted something done, you needed George Washington to be behind it. And then it pretty much got done. So I do think that together, they were ultimately, and it was really Madison pushing, they got the convention called, and it was essential that Washington show up, even though it was not the sort of event he liked. He was not a bookish guy. He was not a deep intellectual. And he was always nervous being around smart people talking about serious subjects, and he felt he might be made to look silly. But he understood his duty, and he did come, which was a tremendous act of leadership. And One of his several gifts was the ability to lend gravitas to a situation. He was really good at that, and he did that. I think when you get into the guts of the convention and the debates go on for 4 months, other people played an important role in different ways. We had a couple of really powerhouse arguers, you know, James Wilson of Pennsylvania and John Rutledge of South Carolina, people we don't think about much. Gouverneur Morris of, it's hard to say where he's from, New York and Pennsylvania. And they were very important, and other leaders played roles at different times. But it is the overall responsibility that they all took for producing something that could change and improve the nation that was the essential act of leadership, and they all shared that.
You touch on how these different figures were leaders in their own way. And as our listeners know, these men that you referenced, especially Madison and Washington, they had very different personality types and different approaches to politics. In your research and the work that you do, what can you tell us about the difference between Washington and Madison and how they work together? It sounds like Madison, as we know, is a real intellectual powerhouse, but Washington kind of carries this gravitas. How did they work together at this convention along with the other delegates?
Well, it's very striking that on one of the first days of the convention, Washington is, of course, chosen to preside, and he steps to the front of the room and assumes the main chair. And Madison scampers up and grabs a seat right next to him. And it's clear, I mean, just that's theater explaining that Washington's the guy, but he's listening to this little guy who's very smart. So they're a team, and that was conveyed. It was understood when the Virginia Plan is presented, that was Washington speaking, and it was understood that Madison had put it together. And that was powerful, that those two leaders were really setting the agenda. When you go through the debates, though, for different reasons, they are not dominant figures. I find, you know, Washington, of course, he's presiding, he's making rulings on procedures, and he doesn't want to get in debate. So he is happy to preside and just let these smart people work this out. Madison is desperate to get in the debate, and he's very eager about it. And he doesn't do as well as we like to think he did. A lot of the things he presents, he doesn't present that well, and he annoys people. He gives up grudgingly when he loses. And there's sort of two periods of the convention. There's the first half before the recess. They take 10 days off. And then the second half. And in the first half, Madison clearly kind of is on the wrong foot, in my take. He's pushing things that people don't want. There's this wonderfully silly proposal he has for Congress to have the power to reverse all state laws. And he presents it 5 times. And it's rejected 5 times. And, you know, really by the third, he should have gotten the message, you know, just leave it alone. He was still relatively young. He's learning how to deal with, you know, powerhouse types. And then in the second half, he seems to have taken some lessons, you know, just in his own mind. And he doesn't flog dead horses. He looks for places where he can improve stuff that's going to happen anyway, or things that have been left out. He's a wonderfully clever man. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, he really can see the gaps, which is a great gift. And he becomes much more valuable. And for me, it's very expressive that the big committee that's set up at the end of the first half is the Committee of Detail, and he's not on it. And instead, they put Edmund Randolph from Virginia on it, and somebody from Virginia had to be on it. And I believe, I never said it in the book quite this way, but it must have killed him not to be on it. He'd worked for a couple of years to prepare for this convention. Then in the second half, at the end, they have the Committee of Style, and he's on that one. And I just think he has shown everybody that he's not just some smart guy. He's also a guy with his own judgment, with an ability to work effectively with others. And they give him the most responsible position left with this one committee. That committee ends up not doing a ton, but it was an important committee, and it was a recognition of Madison. So they played their own roles.
I appreciate the way that you describe these historical events and historical people. I think too often we look at the greatness of these figures and put them on a pedestal almost, and we forget that they are human beings just like you or I, that they made mistakes, had emotions. What can we learn by humanizing these historical figures and trying to understand them as we would another person in our day-to-day lives?
You know, you need to just approach it with your own experience. You know, it's what they tell jurors, bring your common sense. And that is what helps us interpret these people. I was, and others have been also, very struck that the first draft of the Constitution, which comes from the Committee of Detail, is just appallingly pro-slavery. The final product is pretty pro-slavery, but it's much worse when it comes out of the Rutledge Committee. And nobody says anything. And then finally, Gouverneur Morris gets up, and he's just this sort of Vesuvius of a personality, and he can't shut up. I mean, he actually spoke more often than anybody else at the convention, but he just erupts and denounces slavery, says it's a curse on the land that will curse this land forever. And he makes people think about it a different way. And we see what he's done, and then other delegates who are better at cutting deals, which Morris really wasn't too good at, step in and look for ways that they can pare back some of the pro-slavery stuff. And that is ultimately, you know, some of it gets knocked out. So that's, for me, you know, Rufus King is one of the guys who comes in and makes the deal from Massachusetts. And I don't think Morris could have made the deal. He was too impatient with people. He was too sure he was right. He just didn't have the deal-making gene, but others did. So you get a sense for how they work differently. And I do wonder if he hadn't been there, would anybody have raised a fuss about slavery? Because, you know, they did know that several of the southern states would not join this new government without some protection for slavery.
And I think that really ties back to this conversation about different kinds of leadership and how people show up in that space. And as you mentioned, Washington is kind of leading by simply being in the room. His presence has apparently this real power and almost lends legitimacy to the convention, whereas Madison has this great intellect. But as you just described, he is not really great at the personal dynamics. He's kind of struggling with how to navigate that environment. What different types of leadership do we see at the convention, and how do we see that playing out through American history and the lessons we can glean?
Well, I would emphasize, with Washington in particular, the role of character. He was recognized as a man of integrity and a man of duty. And, you know, he spent 8 years running that army, and it was not a fun experience, and it was very hard. And he felt the need to do this duty. He was coming back to this convention because he felt he needed to do that. And that commanded great respect. I was struck, though, when you read the debates, and I read them 5 or 6 times, and, you know, you feel like you know these people, and we're all dependent on James Madison, who took the notes, that he got their voices right. But one fellow in particular kept standing out to me, was this fellow John Rutledge from South Carolina, because when he would speak, the debate moved. People would either disagree with him, pick a fight, or accept what he said and move on to the next step. And this happens many times. And he has this ability to crystallize what's going on and to phrase it in a way that people can react to. Whereas in this first half of the convention that I was talking about with Madison, I was just dazzled that bunches of times, and, you know, we're all raised to think of Madison as the genius. He would speak, and he sat down and was like he hadn't spoken. I mean, they just go off and talk about something else. He's not framing the debate. He didn't have that gift at that time, and he develops it through that summer. So the different people have different talents. You know, Rutledge had the ability to see an alliance he might make, a way he could get support for some issue he wanted from another couple of state delegations that were necessary to go forward. That is a different kind of gift.
This conversation really resonates with me, just hearing that George Washington wasn't necessarily this fearless military leader. He didn't really want to go to the convention. That wasn't really his scene, but he wanted to go out of a sense of duty. And I think it's helpful, at least for myself and hopefully for others, to hear about how leadership and courage is not always about being fearless or about having all the knowledge or data that you need, but it's about your integrity and choosing to do what is right and to live into your values.
Exactly. And I don't want to portray him as some dope who's just standing in front of the room. He was very clear the three things he wanted out of this convention. And I'm sure he was clear about this in conversation. I know he was clear about it in correspondence, which is one, there had to be an executive branch. Two, the national government had to be superior to the state governments. And three, the national government had to be able to levy taxes. Otherwise, you don't have a government. And almost no time is spent at the convention on those three issues because, well, Washington wants them. So they're not going to say no. And in many ways, the best kind of battle when you win it before it even starts. And he had that ability to let people know what he wanted. And he didn't care, to be honest, about a lot of the particular details. He figured that they'd work out, whereas Madison was a devil on the details and very smart about them. So, you know, Washington approached it his way. He wanted these three basic principles, and nobody was going to say no to him, and he got them.
And it sounds like there's also a lot of value in his leadership style in knowing what were not his strengths and who he needed, for example, Madison, to be interested and engage with those details. And so this ability to collaborate with others and be part of a team, I think, is a key aspect of the leadership you're describing.
Washington always wanted some smart guy close to him. He respected intelligence. When he was a soldier, a general, he always had meetings with his generals before any big battle. And you could see, and I worked on his leadership style, he would listen to all 10, but frankly, he was most interested in Nathaniel Greene, what he said. Now, you develop trust in someone, and he had that way as a political leader. Madison, in this period, was his closest political ally and confidant. For 5 years, he just totally relied on Madison. And then Madison becomes more engaged with Jefferson and their different political attitudes. And Hamilton steps into the breach. And Washington hangs on to Hamilton because he's pretty much just as smart. And he's very talented at writing things, which Washington was shy about his own ability at. And so he would always try to have somebody closer to hand who he trusted and who had complementary talents.
So, David, you have an extensive career in law. You've done research and written several books, as we mentioned earlier. And I think you bring a really unique lens to this conversation about how we talk about the past and make it engaging to people today, which is a pretty challenging task. What can you tell us about kind of your process in humanizing these individuals like Madison, like Washington? And how do we continue to make the past accessible to people today?
David McCullough said this better than anybody, and I won't get it right, but, you know, for understanding the past, we have only their words, their buildings, the places they walked through, and I think the utensils they used. That's it. That's what we work from. So you've really got to sort of overanalyze stuff some of the time. And frankly, sometimes you realize I will step back and say, you know, maybe I'm putting too much weight on this. Maybe it wasn't that big a deal. But you know, if I can find an episode, an anecdote that reveals character, and that's always what we're trying to demonstrate, like Gouverneur Morris's speech on slavery, that revealed courage. It revealed guy, frankly, didn't care if he ticked people off. And that tells us a lot about him and how people reacted to him. We know people like that. And that's what you have to try to appreciate. And I don't think James Madison could have done that. And Madison did things that Gouverneur Morris couldn't do. So you're looking for those cues, those clues that tell you what you can find. I was struck in working on Washington. We see him as this remote, frosty figure. But the man wept in public. That wasn't done a lot in the 18th century, and it isn't done at all now. And he wasn't embarrassed about it. He did it several times. And I think that told me that he was a man of great feeling. He was not somebody who had emotional fits or, you know, was ranting and raving. He did, in fact, have a bad temper on a bad day. It could happen. Not often, but it did. But that revealed a vulnerability to me, which, you know, we don't get from the Gilbert Stuart portrait, which we don't get from the image on the coins, although nobody gets coins anymore. And, you know, that is important for us to appreciate when we're trying to understand how he did what he did.
The conversation today is very insightful. I've learned personally from this engagement with you that leadership and learning about the past is not simply about the events or the dates. It's also very valuable to look at the people and their emotions. What are their struggles? And it seems like we can take a lot of insight from that and apply it to our lives today, to politics, as well as how we lead within our organizations. Are there any final thoughts you'd like to share with us today?
I'm always a little leery about taking lessons from the past for the present, because the present looks very little like the past. But the human beings that populate it are the same and don't change very much. And I would probably circle back to the notion of the importance of character. You see this in that generation of the founding era. They talked about that openly. Hamilton, Adams, Washington, to be sure. Character defined you. And I think we need to remember that. It may not matter so much one vote or, you know, one soundbite. What matters is, do you trust this person? Has this person got the welfare of others in mind? And I hope we can think about that more.
This sense of being dedicated to the public good.
Yeah.
Is a very powerful form of leadership in and of itself. It's a quality I think we look for in elected officials as well as the people we surround ourselves with.
We should.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on this podcast. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
And thank you to all of those listening to this show. We hope you'll share it with your family and your friends. Please join us again in 2 weeks as we consider the Constitution.